Welcome back or welcome to the Defining Endurance Podcast. I'm your host, Coach Andrew Simmons from Lifelong Endurance, and my guest today, the athlete care manager from Scratch Labs, Colette Vartanian. Colette, thank you so much for popping on with me today.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm super excited to finally be here after months of talking about this.
This one has been, it's been in the oven for a little bit. Since we're going to talk about food today, I think I'll stick with some food analogies.
Exactly. Definitely. We love the food analogies.
Well, you know, it's been an interesting history for me because I first found Scratch Labs like back when it was still the like silver bag with the secret label on it. Like I remember like 2013, I was like, what's happening up in Boulder? Like you started to kind of see like that it was something different than, you know, just the Gatorade mix that I can't tell you how many times I would go to the like 7-Eleven and like I ran with my credit card a lot because I would just go and get a Gatorade. Like it was the simplest, easiest way to hydrate, but I didn't really understand hydration, right? Like I remember for hot races, I remember when I found Enduralytes from Hammer and I'm like, oh, okay, so I can take these, but I hate it. I can't remember how many times I like aspirated like one of those veggie cap pills because it like, it's dry. Like it got caught in my throat and like I could taste it like burping back up, which wasn't fun. So I was kind of like, oh, cool. Someone's got something better. And it still was not mainstream for a long time. So that was kind of my first experience with like Scratch was getting it and going like, oh, I can make my own bottle of mix. And like, you know, I'm not super flavor sensitive, but my wife is. And so for her, like something that isn't like, oh, blue raspberry to the face, like it's nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Scratch started as a very small company. We're still a small independently owned company in Boulder, Colorado. Started with drink mixes, secret drink mix made in paint buckets at McGuckin's Hardware in Boulder. So we've really come a long way from there as far as incorporating the science. We've always been very science driven, but also finding really innovative and tasty products for people. That is one of our core drivers to picking new products is it has to taste good. Because if you're an athlete and you're eating this stuff for a long time, you want it to taste good.
Yeah. Oh man, I can still remember eating like it literally looked like a pressed like piece of toffee. Like I remember power bars. Like I can't remember how many power bars I ate over the years. And I'm just like, this isn't food. That was the big thing that impressed me about Scratch is that it not only does it look like food by majority, it is real food. You guys use a lot of real ingredients, but sometimes real ingredients can also not taste great. Like there's almost like this need I think I see from other brands where it's like, we are real food and they are so hard into the being real food that they sometimes sacrifice texture and taste. And if I'm going to eat five of something, like I do want it to be uniform, but I also want it to, I just want it to taste good. I don't care if it looks like it's a, you know, if it is like a pressed rectangle, like it's got to taste good. And I want to look at it and go, yeah, I can identify what some of these things are on the label. So that's what has kind of continued to be something that I recommend to my athletes for Scratch.
Yeah, I agree. It has to taste good for you to want to keep doing it. All sports is keeping consistent with whatever you're doing, whether it's your training, your nutrition, your recovery. So if you can't keep consistent with your nutrition because it tastes bad, you are setting yourself behind. And so
no doubt.
I think that makes a huge difference to find the thing you like, whether it's Scratch or not. I think there's so many great products out there, but I will say that being a sports dietitian, I've tried pretty much everything on the market at this point. And I was always drawn to Scratch from the first time I remember trying it.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about that sports dietitian background there. I know that we kind of jumped into like, Scratch. But let's take a step back. And so sports dietitian, you know, you and I actually got connected originally through some work I was doing with Super Sapiens, but your background hasn't always been kind of in the endurance sports realm. You actually come from more of like a, I don't want to call it power sports because it sounds like boats, but like working more with like ball sports and things like that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so I started my career at the University of Southern California as a nutrition intern, and I worked football, I worked basketball, I worked all those sports, became a sports dietitian, and really stuck to the collegiate and pro setting for a long time as far as like mainly male-based sports, team sports. And so I spent a lot of time in that world. I worked with hockey, I worked with basketball, I worked with football, been all over the place. My job's taken me everywhere. Where I started getting into endurance sports, which was really exciting for me. I never considered myself an endurance athlete. I ride bikes, I go on long walks and hikes, I don't really run much. I found that I don't have the mental capacity to run is the hardest part for me. Not that my body physically can't do it. But I was working in a performance center in Indiana, and I got to work with a lot of endurance athletes, put myself out of my comfort zone, and got to really dig into the science. That's why I became a sports dietitian, was because I love science and I love performance. And endurance athletes are the most interested in their performance and see the most results from making adjustments to their performance. So being able to help an athlete one-on-one became so exciting to me that I left team and professional sports completely behind, said it wasn't for me anymore. Tired of feeding people. I love feeding people, but I was tired of only feeding people and not giving them the science on why they were feeding themselves the way they were. So that's kind of like my backstory and how I ended up at Scratch. And now I can't see myself doing something different. I also, weirdly, as a sports dietitian, worked in the consumer packaged goods industry as well at the same time as being a sports dietitian. So now being at a consumer packaged goods company and being a dietitian and taking care of our athletes really takes all my experiences and helps benefit all our customers and all our athletes.
I mean, I got to imagine Alan saw your resume. I was like, done, you know, like that's exciting to see that you have that all comes together. And I look at that and say, like, yes, every sport involves athletes that sweat. Mm-hmm. But to your point, I don't think that, and again, you know, this is me on the outside looking in on a soccer player, a football player, like the benefit that they're going to see is probably more from an energy perspective, that they may feel a little bit better in game. You know, but water versus electrolytes, even from, you know, that standpoint, and maybe is worth kind of my first question here is like, when we think of more of a static performer, right, versus someone that's going to swim, bike, and run, or run, are we going to see a big performance benefit from hydration for workouts that are like inside that hour? Like if I'm going to go to the gym, and I'm going to go lift weights, right? Mm-hmm. And I am an endurance athlete. So if I go and lift, I'm not doing it from the standpoint where I'm not doing CrossFit or, you know, HIIT stuff. Mm-hmm. Am I still going to get a benefit out of drinking that in session, or are the benefits really going to be afterwards that I don't have to try and replace the electrolytes as much? Is it just, am I getting ahead of myself? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Am I going to see a performance benefit in the weight room in that session by drinking an electrolyte mix?
Not necessarily, especially for anybody that's exercising under an hour. Obviously staying in fluid balance is really important. If you're not a heavy sweater, you probably can get away with not drinking during or not needing to drink during an hour of exercise, especially indoors in a weight room. Why hydration is so important is that it's going to play a role in our performance. It's going to help prevent injuries, and it's going to help with recovery. It's going to make sure all those nutrients that you're consuming are flowing through your body productively. So that's why we care about hydration, is because the minute you become dehydrated, all these processes start slowing down. They stop working the way they're supposed to. So if you're an athlete that's going in the weight room and working out for an hour, if you've hydrated really well before and you hydrate well after, you'll be okay. But I do think that when we sweat and we're going for long amounts of time, that's when during it actually makes a huge difference to make sure that your hydration planning is done really well and that you're sticking to somewhat of a schedule when you're taking in nutrition and hydration, because there's so many things that can go wrong that staying on somewhat of a schedule really helps most athletes.
Yeah. You know, you got me interested there. I got stuck when you said injury, because I don't think most people would associate injury and hydration together. Where does that really happen there?
With dehydration, you are basically drying out your muscles, and running with beef jerky muscles versus like hydrated, like fresh cut beef muscles. Like when you think about it, like you think of the analogy, like if you're dehydrated, you're running on beef jerky muscles. And so they have more likelihood of tearing, of not moving nutrients properly through them, all of that. So I think that's why hydration is so important. Also, with hydration comes better decision making. The more dehydrated you are, we've seen it with athletes where their decision making becomes much less proper and they can make mistakes. Yeah. And so making mistakes are not always, you know, sometimes you get lucky, but a lot of the time you can get hurt and injured and then have to deal with that. So it's some decision making, it's some keeping your internal muscles hydrated so that they don't tear or cause any other problems. You're already adding inflammation there. So
I love the beef jerky analogy there. I can easily manage that in my brain.
Yeah.
I want to talk before we kind of dive in, because I want to kind of set a baseline for a lot of people, because I think there's electrolytes, there's sodium. And I think sometimes people only look at the sodium content of something and say, that's my electrolytes. And so, I want to break down the word electrolytes real quick, and we can talk about what that is, but like, we're not plugged in. Like, I don't have an electrical outlet that keeps me going, but there's certainly an electronic component to what we do that helps us, fire those synapses and do all of those fun things with things, words like sarcomeres and all sorts of fun stuff and neurons. So there's a certain electrical part of our body, that is happening. We're not solar powered or battery powered by any means, but explain where electrolytes come into play and why they're important. Like what is an electrolyte?
So an electrolyte is a mineral or vitamin technically that helps you have or remain in homeostasis. Basically, there's lots of pumps and there's lots of connections happening within the intracellular level of your body. And in order for things to communicate and for things to be able to work, you have to have the right balance of certain electrolytes to be able to do their job and get your body moving and maintaining homeostasis. So we have several ones that we find in our sweat primarily that become very important in the way that we hydrate and how fluid moves through our body within the cells and then even in our blood. And so that's where the electrolytes become really important. Our sweat is not just water. It has more to it. Hence why it burns when it gets in your eyes, right? There's definitely more to it than just it being water that you're losing. So that's where electrolytes become very important. And I can dig deeper into those electrolytes if you'd like.
Ooh, well, I want to, because one of the things, and I think this is worth talking about, because when we do sweat, right? Like we can talk about like osmotic values and things start to kind of get a little interesting. One of the things I try to explain to athletes, and we get to pressure test my thinking a little bit, which I think is fun. You know, I've always thought in my brain that as we lose sweat, right, we don't replace it, right? Dehydration, blood gets thicker, right? And we go from this really nice viscous, like thin fluid, mm-hmm. and then we go to this much thicker fluid. And part of the reason we might see something like cardiac drift later in a race or later in an effort is now that pump, our heart, has to work harder to push a thicker fluid, right?
Right? Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of changes that happen in our plasma volume, and that's where we are trying to maintain plasma volume. Plasma is your blood. When your volume changes, it changes the way that your heart beats. It changes how much oxygen your muscles receive. It can really make a lot of things different. But yes, you're absolutely correct, where that lack of hydration can change not only the way you're performing, but the way your heart is pumping, which is crazy. And we see a lot of the signs of dehydration being those kinds of things that are not always easily recognizable by like the human eye. It's how is your heart beating? What's your core body temperature? All of those things start changing as your hydration status changes.
And one of those things, right, is that, you know, hydration status changes. Like it's not just a factor of dehydration, which is, I think, what people tend to worry most about. Like, oh, are we in a constant state of dehydration? But, you know, I think to a friend that I have that's an athlete, and one of the things that they've struggled with is the opposite of actually having hyponatremia, right? So mm-hmm. can you just for a quick, before we really start talking about, you know, all the different things of like hydration, humidity, altitude, those things,
yeah.
let's just talk real quick about, we know we're going to talk about dehydration today,
yeah.
but I want to touch on the opposite side of like, can you hydrate too much?
Yeah, actually you can. So our sweat, like I said, is not just water. There's electrolytes in it, but there are some electrolytes that we have more, that we sweat out more than others. So if you think about sweat and think about a water droplet, a big proportion of that is going to be sodium. That is that's the electrolyte we're going to sweat out the most. Following along after sodium is calcium, magnesium, potassium. Those are the four primary electrolytes when we're really thinking about sweat and sports drinks and all of those things. We lose 90% sodium. That's going to be the biggest component of what we're sweating out. So our sodium concentration in our body and the flow of where sodium is living is really important in order to maintain proper hydration status and not under or overdo it. So if you just drink plain water when you're exercising or even outside of exercise, you could basically waterboard yourself is the analogy that I like to use, and overdo the water where it dilutes all those electrolytes you potentially had in your body or been consuming to not be able to do the things that they're supposed to do, all those connections that they have in our cells and all the ways they maintain our body's normal homeostasis. So we can essentially overdo water and dilute everything in our body. So nutrients are not moving as efficiently. You have so much water, you're basically urinating clear, which is never really, people always think clear is great, but clear means you've drank too much fluid with not enough electrolytes. So those are the things that happen with hyponatremia. Hyponatremia just means not enough sodium in the blood system or the fluid system in our body. So in order to make sure you don't get there, you need to consume electrolytes, whether it's in your food, it's in what you're drinking, in the products that you use throughout training, there has to be some sodium. Magnesium, calcium, potassium, we typically get enough with what we're eating and drinking regularly, and they're not as important in the balance during exercise. So I don't really focus on them as much as I do sodium, because there's also a huge variability component to how much sodium people lose. So hyponatremia is real. It happens a lot. Most commonly I've seen it with younger athletes who are attempting the gallon challenge is a big one that a lot of people talk about. And like, you'll see a lot of athletes, younger athletes especially, carrying a gallon water jug with them everywhere they go, trying to drink all that water. What they're doing is really diluting themselves, and their body mass is not very large. So they're really drinking a lot more than they should be, and then fainting at practices, or having all sorts of other issues that look like signs of dehydration, but are actually signs of overhydration. Yeah, so really fascinating.
It is really interesting, because I think a lot of people like think that, oh, well, right, this falls in, this is one thing that just seems to follow endurance athletes around us. More equals better, right? And we can all kind of overdo it. Let's talk on the last piece here. One of the words that tends to come up, we used to see this a lot, not going to hate on CrossFit too much on this podcast, but let's talk rhabdo real quick. And what is it, right? So we can get a little bit of blood in the urine, but it's not just, hey, you've got blood in your urine. What's actually happening with rhabdo, and how does it come into play with hydration?
Right. So rhabdo can be easily detected, but people don't know about it. That's the crazy thing. And so it's something that I educate a lot in when I give talks on hydration, that you have this spectrum of urine color, and clear is never good, but also black, brown, dark colored urine is also not good, and can be a really steadfast sign that you may be experiencing rhabdo. And what happens with rhabdomyolysis, I always tend to butcher that word.
Me too.
It's basically a condition in which you're either overtraining, typically it's overtraining, and not properly balancing, your hydration and your fueling, and even just knowing what your limits are, and basically damaging the tissue. And now it's releasing its proteins and electrolytes. And we don't want that to happen. We don't want that free roam of protein and electrolytes. And what we typically see quickly is there's extreme pain, and there's usually a colored urination and some other symptoms, but typically can come from not being very well prepared going into a harder workout.
Or, just having, not having a good limiter on your ability, right? Pushing too hard and beyond, and pushing through that, right? That's where I think it shows up a lot in long endurance events, is where it's just not taking care of and not keeping that in balance. And I think that's where this gets hard, is that there is no individual, we can individualize hydration. And I think the question that I wrote down actually is hydration trainable? Is that something that we can train, Colette? Is it something where I can go out and, it could be 90 degrees and it's hot. Can I train myself to be able to do that hour run safely without hydrating? I know that sounds like a terrible idea, but is it trainable?
I don't believe it is. Just from what I know, you can do a lot of things beforehand to help make it easier for yourself, but it's not like running where you can like slowly run faster every week. You can't just slowly drink more water and then hold it in like a camel and like be fine. It's not like nutrition where you can train your gut to be able to take on more fuel during exercise. It needs a little bit more attention in the moment. So when it comes to training with hydration, the training part is really getting yourself used to knowing your hydration status, like your signs of dehydration, knowing how much feels good and doesn't really mess with your stomach, and the sloshiness that sometimes happens, making sure that you know what is in your sweat to be able to replace the right amount so you don't have to drink as much fluid. And then also thinking about the bookends of your workout, so pre and post. Prior to this, what were you drinking? Like, did you have electrolytes? Did you prepare for this so that you went in as hydrated as you possibly could, so that for an hour you could get away with having a small 12-ounce bottle, but you came in well hydrated, so you can make up for it after. But for longer runs, you can't really train better hydration other than the practices of learning how to hydrate well. You can't turn into a camel. I wish we all could, especially runners. I know you guys hate carrying stuff. So I know that carrying water sucks, but it's necessary. And we wish we could just store it internally and not have to bring stuff with us.
Right. Yeah. Go maybe light. Right. Evolve. Like that's kind of,
who knows?
Yeah, I know. That'd be really cool. Like, I don't know. Like then, but then you start, that gets a whole different podcast. evolutions of athletes. Yeah. I know that we're going to come into a part of this episode. So for those that are interested, keep listening. We're going to kind of go through our rules of thumb selection around like, mm-hmm. What can we drink before and what should we be doing after? Can we chronically dehydrate ourselves and how do we get out of a hole and things like that? I do mm-hmm. want to talk about those, but I want to talk about conditions. I think one of the things that I have learned about myself is being an athlete from Michigan, generally a humid place, and then moving to Colorado, like I feel like I actually have to care about my electrolyte balance out here in Colorado versus like Michigan. I was like, I feel like I was hydrated just breathing because the air has so much water in it. Mm-hmm. So let's talk like humidity versus altitude. Like why is there such an issue? Like every time someone comes into Colorado, everybody's like, make sure to drink your water. And it's almost like a silly thing that we have to tell people. And I don't think everybody understands why altitude plays into hydration.
Yeah, there is a big component there. First of all, with humidity, humidity allows for our sweat to not feel like not feel like you're sweating as much because you're already moist. And so hydration just feels different when you're already like skin wise hydrated, but then also internally there's more like moisture in the air that is also entering your lungs every time you breathe. Whereas you don't have that when you're training in dry weather. You have to make sure you're providing the moisture that your body needs. It's not coming from the environment that you're in. So that's where humidity can make a huge difference. When it's humid, people don't wick their sweat as quickly, so they tend to sweat more. So I find that when my athletes move to more humid, like especially if they're from Colorado or training in Colorado, then they go and do a race somewhere hot like Florida. And there definitely is a difference in the way that you hydrate. You have to hydrate more and you have to hydrate with more electrolytes because you're going to sweat more in that heat and that humidity. When it's drier, you still need fluids. You just need them for a different reason, not because you're sweating more, but typically because you're not provided the moisture that your body needs to breathe and to be able to move the nutrients. So that's kind of the piece of humidity. Everyone deals with humidity in a different way. I didn't grow up with humidity, so I struggle a lot. That's why heat training, sauna training, humidity training, like people actually do those things to help them improve because it's actually something you can improve. You may not be able to improve your hydration, but you can improve your tolerance to the heat. Therefore, with the humidity, you can perform a lot easier than maybe somebody who isn't as acclimated. When it comes to altitude, the reason that we care more about hydration in altitude is because with entering higher levels, really, I think about where it really matters is over 8,000 feet. Anything under 8,000, most of us can definitely like hydrate fuel the same way. But once you get mm-hmm. over 8,000, that's when things definitely change. Hydration becomes much more important because we have less oxygen. So blood needs to be moving much more efficiently through our body. So I definitely say hydration is really important there. again, decision making is a big piece of it. So if you go in dehydrated and you are at altitude and, you know, the lack of oxygen is also affecting your performance and your decision making, that can be a problem. But we also, you know, there's even nutritional components to this. It's not even just hydration that's important at altitude, but if you're an athlete that's training above 8,000 feet, even if it's regularly, you have more nutrient needs, actually. You are burning more calories at altitude and need to be consuming somewhere between 20 to 30% more, which is crazy for people to hear. Everything is just working so much harder at those heights that you need more fluid, you need more food, you need more oxygen, honestly, up there.
Right.
So those are the things that I definitely think about when I send athletes who are going and doing crazy things at higher heights. Bring more hydration with you, maybe higher amounts of sodium so that you can retain that water a lot better. There's lots of different strategies for athletes when they're going to altitude. I say start hydrating early if you can, no matter where you're from or what you do. It doesn't hurt. Everyone, there's so many physiological things happening in our body when we get to that altitude that you want to minimize as many risks as you possibly can.
And that makes me think, like, when I go to altitude and things like that, like the first thing that I notice for me when I'm dehydrated is like, oh, my stomach feels so bound up. And like, I feel like I'm drinking a ton of water, but your gut, you know, I'll use the word motility, your ability to move food through your lower intestine or process food through your lower intestine, like big part of that is hydration. Yeah. So it's like, I think constipation is one thing that people really struggle with at a higher altitudes at first, is they learn how to handle that. Like, is that when it becomes really important to think, oh, I'm going to go up and train for 3 or 4 days at altitude. Like I need to kind of preload my hydration.
Yeah, I definitely think it helps making sure that you're getting enough of the electrolytes that help move the fluid, and making sure you come in well hydrated helps prevent the risk of dehydration, but also allows you to have less chance of some of the things that people notice, like constipation. It really kind of depends on how long you're up there and training up there. You know, if you are training for longer than a day or two, then you definitely need to be making sure you're focusing even longer on your hydration. And even outside of your trainings, there, we usually recommend at least a liter and a half more of fluid when you're up in altitude because of the needs for motility and for just moving nutrients through. I think that also factoring in, if you're going and training in altitude in the hot summer months or the cooler fall weather, like that makes a big difference because you're sweating a different amount. So you have to think about how much you're losing, but then also the extra that you need just because you're in altitude.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the cold and the hot, and I want to get to that, but I think for people that are listening to this that aren't altitude athletes, like where, when you go to altitude, like you, there's a window where your body's like, are we really at altitude, or do we just like, what happened? And then once it realizes that you're at altitude, you start going through this process of trying to create more red blood cells, right? And that's a body process that you normally go through. But when you go to altitude, it's like, oh, right. Cause everything that we're talking about today is about trying to get your body to achieve homeostasis, right? Like that's why we're taking electrolytes, is this drive towards homeostasis. You're trying to build more red blood cells so you can achieve this balance within your body. Your body is always seeking that balance. It's when we shift it outside of that balance is when we see like the extremes of like something like rhabdomyolysis, or we see hyponatremia. Like those are the bookends of the bad. And we're trying to live in this kind of, it's not super narrow. There's a comfortable place we can be, but it's like when you change one of these major factors, whether it's hotter, right? Environmental factors, hot, cold, you know, high, low, dry, humid, like all of those come into play. And I think the last one here, because we've talked altitude, we've talked hot and cold, humid versus altitude. Let's talk hot and cold real quick, because the number one thing that I notice is that when it gets cold out, I don't want to drink. I just don't want to do it.
Yeah. Your drive for thirst starts decreasing when you are in colder temperatures. That is really, really normal for me to see. And that's why having a really good hydration plan, even if you're not thirsty, there's two differing opinions when it comes to hydration. First opinion is drink when you're thirsty. And the second opinion is you should be very scheduled, no matter if you're thirsty or not, to drink. Both have merit in research. We live at scratch in this middle ground of if you have the right stuff in your bottle, you could probably drink when you're thirsty and not when you're not. But there are situations where we have to be more aware. Cold temperatures is always one. Your sweat rate will decrease at cooler temperatures. So you're not going to be sweating as much as you typically would in the summer months. But that doesn't mean you stopped sweating. That doesn't mean you stopped drinking fluids. It just means that that concentration of fluid versus electrolytes might be a little bit different. You might only need to bring, 16 ounces with you, whereas in the summer you take 33 ounces a liter with you. So in the cold, our volume definitely changes, and that's fine. It's totally fine because our sweat rate is changing. So with that, you still can't stop drinking. You just need to drink more electrolytes typically to hold on to that fluid better. What we're worried about is with cold air, there's less humidity. So that allows for breathing rate to change the way fluid is going through our body. And it changes a lot of the water losses that we have. So not even just the sweat, but like our respiration also expires some fluid that we have to replace. So there will be some changes there. Also in the cold, our blood vessels constrict a lot more. And so we want to make sure that blood volume is on point there. And so still drinking enough. Also at cold temperatures, we tend to have to pee more. There's like this diuresis effect at altitude and in cold temperature that makes us feel like we always have to go to the bathroom. So we may pee more frequently and need to replace some of the volume of fluid that we lost there. So we definitely want to not forget to drink. You just might have a different composition that you take out with you. So maybe it's a little bit saltier than what you take in the summer potentially, or it's, you still have electrolytes in there, but you may take a smaller volume. You just don't want to forget to drink. You have to schedule it, especially when you drive for thirst is down. You have to, every 15 minutes, I'm going to take a couple sips. Sometimes I recommend taking warmer drinks with you because it's sometimes it's more likely that you will take a drink. We have a lot of our drinks can be drank warm. I love the matcha lemon. It's probably my favorite. I drink it cold in the summer and warm, not hot, but warm in the winter or fall months when I know I still need something, but I don't want something freezing cold. So there's definitely options. And then also what I always say is that, it might be cold outside, but if you're training indoors in the winter, you're going to sweat just as much as you do in the summer. So your hydration should look different when you do indoor training versus outdoor training in the winter. Just because you're inside, you probably, it's the easiest time to make sure you have everything in front of you. Don't skimp out on the hydration there. Like it's the easiest time to be hydrated where you don't have to carry it with you.
Yeah. Your body doesn't have like some camera inside it where it's like, oh, it's 12 degrees outside, but it's still 70 degrees indoors. And, if you're forced air, right, that's already taking a lot of the humidity out of the air. Mm-hmm. So guess what? You're now in a dry, humid environment, where you're going to sweat, your body's going to want to sweat. So that's why I've noticed definitely if I'm on the bike trainer, I sweat like I do in the summer, but I'll go outside and I am one of those people. I feel like I'm extra sensitive to the cold onset diuresis where like, mm-hmm. I'll go out and I'll have, and I know coffee's a diuretic, but like mm-hmm. I'll have a small coffee and then I'll have some electrolytes in the morning before I go out. But then as soon as I get out that first mile, I'm like, even though I peed before I went out on my run, I'm like, oh my God, I've got to like, and it's not like volume wise. Like it's not like a little like,
just dribble,
I'm like, it's a, yeah. Oh my God. It's like now. Right. And so, I feel that, but I'm glad you brought that up because like I had to go to the doctor and they're like, yeah, it's cold onset diuresis. Like you're basically going through this process of vasoconstriction. And basically it's kind of like if you squeezed a little bit of a sponge that your muscles tighten just a little bit and that tightening causes water to be released. And guess what? That goes into your bladder and fills it right up. And that's why you feel like you have to pee when you're cold.
Yeah. The same thing happens at altitude. So people who are training in altitude that maybe have not before, and you notice that happening, and it's also very normal. And so that's where we are more conscious of our hydration strategies and are prepared for them. So that means you bring a little bit more fluid with you or bring more electrolytes with you just because you know that something might be different than what you're typically used to. But yeah, I hear a lot of athletes have that where they're like, is something wrong with me? Why am I peeing a lot more than I usually do?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
I know, I feel like we could do an entire podcast on like calories and electrolytes. I want to take one other thing here. Before we kind of get into some rules of thumbs on things, because I know we could probably go for 2 or 3 hours talking mm-hmm. all about this, but let's bring the ladies into this. We do have, have to consider that, I don't go through the same things that, you know, women, when they go through their menstruation cycle, like there's an increased need for calories. Mm-hmm. But I think one thing that often gets left behind is that a female athlete may be in their cycle is also going to adjust the balance, not only of calories, but electrolytes. So what's really happening there and why is there an increased need for electrolytes during menstruation?
Yeah. So menstruation puts our body through a lot of different things. There's two main phases, your follicular phase and your luteal phase. They are split up by ovulation, obviously. Maybe it's a lot of TMI for people, but your onset of your period starts the cycle. Those two phases are very different because the hormone levels are very different. And so at different times, your body is oxidizing or using different amounts of different macronutrients, as well as hydration. In the second part of our phase, as we've reached ovulation and are going back towards having our period again, we are noticing body temperature changes that are leading to higher hydration needs. Basically, what's happening is your core body temperature is just raising, and what you need to be able to do is to bring that down with better hydration. Drive for thirst is a lot higher during the second phase of your cycle. And just the types of nutrients that you need. Typically, that second half of our cycle is the most demanding. It wants the most out of us. It wants more calories, specifically carbs and fats, because they are what our brain really, really wants. But they also want more fluid because you're taking in extra nutrition, but also your body core temperature is a lot higher. I mean, not a lot, but for enough to make a difference, a significant difference. And so you want to bring that core temperature down, move those nutrients through, and be able to perform well. That's really the biggest piece of the hydration for the cycle. Also during the first part of the cycle, I find athletes to have a lack of appetite, a lack for thirst, a lot of changes that happen very drastically in a couple weeks and keeps happening. So I always recommend women to track your symptoms, track what your fueling looks like. Is it different? It might need to be different, and that's okay. But there's definitely some different needs for females. And I could do a whole different podcast just on female athlete nutrition. I did a talk this morning and it went almost like an hour and a half because we were so into it.
I'm totally down. I may not be the best host. I might pass you on to Lexi to talk through that.
Yeah, that might be fun.
Yeah, I don't experience it the same way. So okay. I'm looking at it from a coaching perspective.
Yeah, and that's great to be a coach that's aware.
And so I want to talk through another thing. I guess we'll play another round of check Andrew's knowledge here.
Yeah.
I want to talk in the sports realm for a second, because I think one thing that I experience a lot, and I think this is where we can kind of, we'll shift into our kind of rules of thumb. This will be our segue of, you know, check Andrew's knowledge. We need like its own like theme music. But one of the things that I tell a lot of athletes is, when we think about dehydration and we go through this process that, I guess I shouldn't say dehydration, we're actually going to talk calories for a second, that when we're running and we hit threshold, right? So the point at which we're going to increase the demands of our body for more blood to go to the heart, lungs, and brain, and we're exercising, and it's for an extended period of time. Let's say an athlete is climbing a long ascent. Maybe it's a mile or 2 miles, a couple thousand feet of vertical. Heart rate's pretty high. One of the things that happens there is we first start to shunt blood away from the gut. And so it's kind of important to understand what is in our gut at that time, and things that contain fat and protein. I'm making sure I get this right. So that contain fat and protein require more blood to process. And so that is one of the biggest reasons that we use when we're doing a over threshold efforts, that it's actually really important to use carbohydrates versus things that are heavy in fat and protein, because things that are heavy in fat and protein can cause a lot of discomfort because they aren't being processed. And that's where we can get that rock feeling in our stomach. So check my knowledge on that. Am I close?
You're spot on right there. I think that that's the biggest difference that people don't realize, is you can tolerate fats and proteins for a lot of runners, but the minute you go over that threshold, your body does not want that in there at all. And it will do everything to try to get it out, which is why we have runner's gut. And we deal with all those different things that runners deal with, is because the minute your heart rate goes up too high, it doesn't want to process anything more than simple sugars. And preferably, a lot of times I've seen more liquid. It doesn't want stuff that's hard to digest, because there's no blood in your gut to be able to digest it. So it wants as simple as possible. So you're completely right there in what our body wants. So it depends on the type of run, what kind of nutrition you might be bringing, you know?
This is also why, when we think about, and you, if you watch any of the world marathon majors, you will see that by majority, the athletes that are out there, it's not because they're running over threshold. They are superhuman in some ways, but liquid calories are easier for your body to process. They don't have to go through that process of breaking things down, which is why you don't often see, and again, this isn't a hot take, this is the reality. This is why you don't see fat being used as a fuel, even in long distance events, as a primary source of fuel. You're still going to need carbohydrates. And I know that there's going to be people out there that are going to tell me, but Andrew, what about keto? And I follow a keto diet. Do I still need carbohydrates for my long distance events?
Yes. Carbs are always essential for runners. There is a lot of shift away from the keto movement for long endurance type running, ultra running. It's actually moving a lot away from it, because the research we thought was accurate is not as accurate as we thought it was. And our bodies just rely on carbohydrates and use them so much more easily that you're not dealing with a bunch of other processes in your body. And so we are moving towards more liquid nutrition. I think that the game is now liquid nutrition. That's the changing factor for a lot of athletes, is switching from more solids to more liquids. We didn't really see this before, because there weren't quality products out there that could provide the right amount of carbohydrates without causing gut distress. Because before, all we had were primarily simple sugars and like high fructose corn syrup and things like that, where those were causing diarrhea. They were causing cramping. And now we have more specialized products out there that are doing the right work to allow people to do liquid nutrition better.
And so, you know, one of the reasons that I also heard a lot around the fat protein argument is feeling satiated. There we go. So the feeling that you are full. And so I think about some new, products that you guys have, like Super Fuel, right? It's a cluster dextrin. How does that, even though it's in a liquid form, is that going to be enough to help me feel full, or do I need to have like, and I'm going to look over here, right? We got like an energy bar. I've got like some really simple sugar chews. You've also got like the Rice Krispie, I'm gonna call them Rice Krispie treats. In that sense, right? Like, when do I need to start thinking about having something that is going to be, it's going to give me that feeling, even though I need carbs. Where does that fit?
So athletes, everyone's kind of different with their like need for fullness or hunger. I have some athletes who can do, you know, 8-10 hours without food and be fine. They can just do liquid calories and they can get through it. And then I have some athletes who are like, no, every 2 hours, I need something solid because my stomach just needs something sitting in there. Or I get hungry after a while. So everyone's a little bit different. I usually recommend having more of your solid foods earlier or in the parts of the race. It depends on the type of running you're doing too. Is it road running? Is it trail running? Is it, you know, ultramarathons with climbs and all of that stuff? But thinking through like, what does your run look like and where do you have those windows where you're at lower heart rate zones to potentially get more solid food in? I always say at the beginning is always the easiest. And sometimes, so I use a strategy for some runners where it's more solid in the beginning and you move more towards liquid towards the end where your gut is just over it. So there's tons of different strategies. You have to find the one that works for you. And that's why we recommend training with your nutrition to find different types of distances, what works well, what doesn't work well. This might have worked well until you hit 30 miles and you're like, after 30 miles, I can't do this anymore. My gut doesn't work the same way. Everyone's really different. Practice things. I always say start with solids, then move to liquids if you can. Have a balance of foods if you can, mainly carbohydrates. But if you're doing ultra distance stuff, you may want some protein or some fat on board at different points because you're going multiple hours. I mean, you're skipping meals. So you want to make sure you're getting something substantial in there.
And one of the things that's come out, I think, in the last year is that actually the amount of calories that we can consume and truly process, we know now that it is something that we can train, but also the amount at which we can consume. We're starting to see athletes, and this sounds crazy, but they're able to process 450 to sometimes more than that calories per hour. You probably have a greater look at this with working with like Tour de France riders and things like that, but I've seen numbers as high as 600 calories an hour of people being able to put that in. And so is there a good way other than just monitoring the calories that you're putting in and trying to add 20, 30, you know, every time you're going out and training and trying to increase the calorie intake? And what's the argument to do so?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to start off, like people always ask me, well, how many calories am I supposed to have? You want to try to start with about half the calories that you're burning. For most runners, the easiest way to think about this is every mile, it doesn't really matter if you run it or walk it, you're burning about 100 calories. Mm-hmm. Physiologically, that's really where you're at. So figure out how many miles you're running in an hour and then think about half of that is what you need to be starting to consume. I think a lot in grams of carbs. Because that's the main source of energy. So a lot of runners talking calories, my brain goes to grams of carbs per hour. The goal is to get somewhere between 30 and 90 grams of carbs per hour. That translates to, you know, anywhere from 150 to 500 grams of carbs, depending on the person. Like you can have a really wide range. And so starting at a lower point and working your way up, the type of training you're doing is going to make a difference in the type of carbohydrates that you want. You may sometimes be able to mix in complex carbohydrates, but when you get to your longer training, it might be more simple carbohydrates. So figuring out what those sources of carbs are, where you're getting your sources of fuel, and mixing and matching them to see what sits well. You can train yourself slowly. I always say increase by 10 to 20 grams. After like one or two solid training sessions that you felt good. Don't just like, all right, I did 40 grams today, I'm going to switch to 60 tomorrow. Give your body a minute to really make sure that that feels comfortable. You will know you've had too much by cramping, diarrhea, bloating. Those will be indicators of you having maybe not met that threshold yet. So those are the things I look for. Those are like the typical advice that I give to most athletes. But I'm seeing athletes consume 120 grams of carbs an hour. That's a lot of fuel. That's almost 500 calories an hour. Yeah.
It's high. It's high, but it's not unreasonably high. And I think that's why we're starting to see some of these performances really, truly, right? Everybody's like, oh, it's the shoes. And I'm like, no, actually, we probably just understand that what we can do more of and have a strategy that is alongside, you know, this periodized strategy that you take to build your fitness, like take that same methodology and approach and change running to calories. And now you can start to see that, like, you have to fuel more. And this is like the huge argument for, yes, you have to fuel your body. You have to fuel the machine. You know, more is, this is the one time I would tell people that in the running game, more is more. You know, when you do train your body to process more calories and you can give it more calories, like fire burns hotter. A hotter flame is higher energy. It requires more fuel to create a hot fire. And so if you want that fire to burn for a long time, you have to put a lot of calories into it. And so, you know, I think to a guest we've had on this podcast twice, Kevin Goldberg, he runs 200 plus mile events. And, you know, yeah, sure. Everybody would probably look at his diet and go, that guy eats like a garbage disposal. And it's like, well, yeah, because he's taught his body how to eat, you know, just about anything he can throw at it. Because at that point it is calories. It is a game of calories in because he's going out for so long, but his heart rate is also super low. So he can get away with eating two slices of pizza in an aid station because he's going to go hike out of there before he goes and gets his heart rate high 90 minutes later, going up a climb. Like there is a strategy to it.
Yeah. Practicing the strategy, seeing what feels good, paying attention to it is like the biggest piece of it. You can really surprise yourself at the things that you can eat out there. Mm-hmm. I always get surprised by what my athletes tell me that they're eating. But sometimes what I say is start with some simple stuff. Fruit, pretzels, dried fruit, rice, applesauce. Yep. Like start with some simple things, see if those are sitting well when it comes to real food, because gels and bars and chews and all those things, like you pretty much know what you're getting yourself into and you can train with those things. But trying to add some variety if you can, like if your stomach can handle it, add some bananas, add some pretzels here and there. You're going to get so many more benefits from it. If you can try to add some variety, it also makes it a lot less boring. We love rice at Scratch. So we make rice cakes, rice balls. You can really do a lot with rice. You can eat it for breakfast, lunch, dinner. It has a lot of moisture in it. So it's a lot easier on the gut than some other carbohydrates can be. So it's a great place to start if you're not sure, is to make some rice and try eating some rice on a run and see how it feels. It's a great way to start getting solid food in.
Yeah. I think to Yuri, who is a, you know, former Scratch employee, you know, one of the things we talked about on our episode together was like, go get a muffin, go get a croissant. Like these things, they taste good. And they're almost like, they are part of the fun of then training is you're like, I've got a blueberry muffin in my bag that like mile 12 where it's going down. I'm going to destroy that muffin because I'm looking forward to it versus
it gives
like
you something to look forward to.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. And I think some people get afraid and almost confine themselves to, oh, I don't, well, I know that these three things I can eat and they work. And it's like, yeah, but like our guts change, right? Like you mentioned, like fat and all of those things, they're hormonal, right? Like fat is, we need fat in our diet because it helps us, you know, process and manage our hormone production, right? Like it's so important. Fat is an important thing to have. I'm not a, you know, vilifier of fat by any means, but then at the same sense, like don't confine yourself to like, these are the three things that have worked and they will always work. Like always be trying new things in your training cycle because you might surprise yourself with like what you can do as you increase your fitness, what you could process when you were in worse shape. And now that you're in much better shape, changes. I know where
and there's,
go ahead.
I was going to say, and like back to demonizing food, like there's no bad food out there for you for fuel. If candy is the thing that works for you, fine. If fruit is the thing that works for you, great. Like everyone is a little bit different. Food is fuel. It is going to work for you. Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be. Obviously we care about the quality of our food, but there's sometimes where like you are running all the time, you are training all the time, you gotta have some variety, you gotta have fun with it. Otherwise it becomes a chore and not like the reason why you started running, for enjoyment.
Heck yeah, we could another podcast another day on how food and enjoyment go together. Right. I know we've hit that magical hour mark, and I'm like, I'm looking at like what we want to talk about. I'm like, oh, we could do a whole nother episode. I think what we'll do to kind of close things out is I've got a couple of Instagram questions, but I did promise those rules of thumb, meaning I know people are sitting here going, oh, but what about my question about the marathon? How many calories per hour? So let's do a quick, I'll shoot you kind of a distance. And then we'll kind of have a little bit of fun of like, what are some strategies for fueling there? If we can, I know that that's probably not quite so simple, but
yeah, I can actually keep it really simple if you want.
Let's go
with the, all of that.
Let's go for it.
I find it really doesn't matter the distance that you're running. Like we said, there's a threshold every hour that we want to hit. It doesn't matter if you're eating it, at the start of the hour, four times within the hour, at the end of the hour, our body will take those calories whatever way. So it's all about what sounds comfortable, but the goal is to hit somewhere between 30 to 90 grams of carbs per hour, with around 400 milligrams of sodium at least every hour. So those are really key things that it doesn't matter what distance you're running, you're going to need to hit those mile markers and figure out what the nutrition is going to look like. Obviously, if you're going longer, maybe you're hitting, you know, less miles per hour or more miles per hour, whatever it is. So your amount might change. Your heart rate, if your heart rate is higher, your products might change. But it's really not complicated. Anything over an hour, that's the strategy you're going to use. And so it keeps it really simple as a place to start. And then from there, if you've nailed that, you've figured out how all that works, then we go into more personalization. But you got to start with the basics. And then anything under an hour, if you do your fueling before and after, right? So you have a good breakfast, you have a good snack, then you come home and you have a good recovery, you don't really need to have much within that hour. Anything over an hour is where we really care about adding nutrition and practicing that nutrition. So doesn't matter half full ultra, same strategy I use with all my athletes. I think that that's where you start to keep it simple because I feel like it's gotten much more complicated than it needs to be. Hydration, carbohydrates, and enjoy yourself. Like that's all you need.
Totally. And I'm so glad that like we just like cut to the chase of like, here's the baseline, right? If it's hot, you're going to have to adjust that, right? That what changes there is the environmental factors, right? And so the reality is like, that's the main baseline to work with. And if you find you need more or less, like add that more or less in. The last question I have for you before we get into the Instagram side of things, if I'm in a hydration hole, let's say I've been a bad person, I've gone out for my 90 minute or 2 hour run, I only had like a handheld that had like 12, maybe a 16 ounce handheld, and I had water, and I come back, I got my salt stains, and I'm in a rough spot. I got that nice lightheaded feeling. And I might feel a little worse than that, right? Like I'm not feeling too great. What is the best protocol to kind of get me out of that hole so that tomorrow I'm not a complete nightmare?
Yes. So that happens to all of us at some point, whether it's on a run or you completely butchered your travel day and didn't drink any fluid and now you're in a dehydration hole and you got to get out there again tomorrow. What are you supposed to be doing? First thing is obviously volume of water, like getting something like a good amount in after your workout. Recovery isn't just carbs and protein. It's also fluid. You have to replenish that fluid that you've lost. So getting, you know, a bottle with some electrolytes in there, preferably if you can do more electrolytes than you usually do. So like a regular scratch is somewhere around 800 milligrams of sodium per liter, or perhaps like per serving is around 350-60. I can't remember off the top of my head right now.
Looked at
380. Man, I am off a little bit. But basically, what you're trying to do is maybe do double of that. We also have a wellness that has double the amount. And we also have a hyper. If you are in a hole, if you are really in a hole, you want to find something that is as salty as your blood so that it can rapidly hydrate you. And we have a hyperhydration. That's 3,500 milligrams of sodium per liter. Salty ocean water. Find something salty. If it's not that you have scratch available for you, miso soup, top ramen, all those salty things that we typically stay away from, go ahead and have something like that. V8 juice, tons of sodium in there. Have something salty to get your blood sodium back to normal and so that that plasma volume is now balanced. Get yourself something, pump that electrolytes back in, get some good carbs and protein in as well, just because they help maintain energy status, and you'll be fine for the next day. But increasing that sodium intake if you're already dehydrated and then drinking as you're thirsty. Super important.
Yeah, that hyperhydration, I've tried it and have had great success with it. But if you don't drink it with the mix it with the appropriate amount of water, it's like licking a 9-volt battery. Like it's like, whoa. Like it is potent. It is a potent, potent product.
It's weird because I don't taste it like other people do, but we call it salty ocean water at Scratch.
Yeah.
It is salty. But definitely works. But if you don't have Scratch available, I think there's so many things out there. You can even run into a 7-Eleven and grab something. All you're looking for is a good amount of sodium, somewhere over 700 milligrams in a serving. And that will get you back to hydrated a lot better.
I love that.
Make sure you're still drinking fluids too.
Yeah.
I just think that you have to be practical. Sometimes you don't have everything. You traveled, they lost your suitcase. You got to figure something out, right?
Yep. And that's where the single serve packets have saved my butt, is that when I buy Scratch, I buy single serve as well as the bag, because they're going to probably be a little suspicious about the white powder that you just randomly have in a baggie. So do yourself a favor. And next time you go to buy some Scratch or your electrolyte drink of choice, we're not sponsored. Mm-hmm. But for Scratch, like, using the individual packets is great, because now you also know exactly how much you're using versus like this bag is this many calories. That is the other thing I really like about a lot of your products, is Scratch is 7 scoops of Superfuel. It will get you this many calories. But if you're trying to give yourself a specific amount of calories, like adjust the scoops, man, like it's not crazy. Yeah.
Mixing and matching is also very normal in our realm. So mix things to make it what you need to.
Yep.
You can experiment. We always say you're your best experiment. You are going to know what works well for you. Play around with things. Find what works really well. Traveling is always really hard with products. If you're traveling with Scratch, try to travel with it unopened, because they give you less of a headache with it.
Yeah. We've got two questions here from Instagram. I asked, our audience, just a couple things. And I said, what questions do you have around hydration? Talking with Scratch Labs today. And the first question we got is there a simple equation that I can use when out on the MTB for short and long rides? And my curiosity is does that baseline we talked about earlier with carbs, does that change on the bike versus the run?
Really doesn't. It doesn't matter what you're doing. You're going to have an easier time eating on a bike than you are with a run because there's not that added component of the gut jolting as much. So you can tolerate a lot more. Same strategy though. You want to get a good amount of fluid in. You want to get somewhere between 30 to 90 grams of carbs. If you are going harder, I always say go higher on the range. If you are taking it more casually, you could go on the lower end of the range. And that counts for both your fluids and your food. They both typically usually have carbs in it. So you just combine that carb content and you have your number and you just meet that range based off what feels good for you and what your baseline is. I can't tell you necessarily unless I know what you're eating. So those are the same rule of thumb I would follow for any sport, to be honest, that's endurance based.
Love that. I think one of the things is I'll have to get my kids, my kids that are going out 10, 12 miles in their long run. You got to be eating during that. So yes. One of the questions here came out, says, other than having to take breaks, can you drink too much? And I think what I'll ask there instead of that question, because I think the real root of the question is that, and I think you kind of answered it in the mountain bike question, is how much should we drink per hour? Because I think a lot of people are looking at, should I be drinking an ounce to 2 ounces every mile in my marathon or whatever that is? And so If we're not equating, if I'm having some scratch chews and that's my carbohydrates, well, what do I do with the other hand that's got a raw bottle of water in it? Like, because they're not together now. Like, now that they're separated,
yeah.
What should I be looking at?
Yeah. So when it comes to fluid intake, minimum I usually recommend is somewhere between 14 ounces up to, like, most people can comfortably get somewhere between 14 to 16 ounces to 24 ounces per hour. Mm-hmm. I usually say keep it simple, 16 ounce bottle. Try to get at least one of those every hour. If you need more, it's hotter, do more than that. But you can't, your body's really good at telling you that you've had too much water. Mm-hmm. You'll get sloshy in your stomach. You just at some point can't get any more down. Where I've seen people be able to stop is around 30 ounces, almost at a liter is where people are all right, I got to back off now because I've done too much in an hour.
Yeah.
So kind of figuring it out. And if you are the type that typically drinks less, just make sure there's a good amount of electrolytes so that you can hold on to the amount that you are drinking. But that's kind of where I think about things. If you have water, I really advise against plain water during exercise. It makes it more complicated. If that's the only situation you have, then there's options out there like salt sticks and other things out there to make sure you're getting enough electrolytes or just having salty foods with you. Mm-hmm. But typically I just think it's easier if you can make sure you have something in your bottle. If you hate the taste of sports drinks, there are stuff out there that tastes like water. I mean, we at Scratch have a product called Clear. That is really great, but you can also just find some other products out there that have just plain electrolytes if it gets you through what you like doing. I know that there's a lot of differences, but that's my keys for hydrating. Start at 16 ounces, see how you feel. Work your way up if you need to, depending on the temperatures and your sweat rate. Sweat rate is a huge component of this. We didn't even touch on it, but if people are curious about sweat rate, feel free to reach out to us at Scratch. We can always help you figure that out. But it's a very simple equation that most people do. And that equation changes throughout the year, type of exercise. The volume in which you sweat is going to change. So your volume of fluid you're going to drink is probably going to change too.
Right on. I was going to say, let's, yeah. You guys do hydration testing and sweat rate testing there.
Yeah, we do sodium sweat testing. With sweat rate, I usually send people home with a form and fill it out and bring it in with them or email it to me and we can figure out sweat rate. But there's definitely testing that we do. I don't think everybody needs hydration sodium testing, but I do think that if you're struggling with hydration, the amount of sodium in your sweat could be the reason why you're struggling, and we can dial that in.
I love it. You know, I know we could, I know we could talk for another hour, about all sorts of things around how do we bounce out of a hole when it comes to, you know, if you do throw up in the middle of an ultra because your stomach went south on you, what are some ways that we get you back? Yeah. And like, we'll have to just leave that for another episode. But Colette, yeah. I wanted to make sure that people, you know, what is the best place for people to find either resources from you? Is it best to go to Scratch Labs? Like, where can people find and learn more information if they have questions here?
Yeah. So the easiest ways to get more information is to go on scratchlabs.com and check out our blogs. You can also message us at info@scratchlabs.com. They can connect you to me, or they can answer the question you have potentially from stuff that I've written for our team and to educate them, and they can help you out. Our team is really amazing at being able to help our customers. But also you can reach me at Cole Nutrition on Instagram. And that's another easy way. If you have a question, you want to shoot me a DM, totally fine. I will answer things. But yeah, lots of different ways to get information. Whatever is easier for people, I'm game for that.
I love it. This was a super insightful episode. I even learned a couple things there along the way. Actually, I learned a whole lot. And this only going to help you know, educate the people out there. So Colette, I really appreciate you coming on today. We'll have to schedule a future episode, I think, because I think this is going to spark some questions. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. Thank you, Andrew. Take care.
Take care.